Y'all ready to proceed? All right, our clerk will call the second case, please.
The court will now call Nathan Robinson and Misty Robinson et al. Versus Homeowners Management Enterprises Incorporated et al. Okay, please report. Mr. Mark A. Heiser will argue for the appellant. Mr. Edward Baines will argue for the appellate.
Mr. Heiser?
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm honored to represent the Robinsons here today in this appeal. I think both sides would think the answer to this question, the two questions that are posed, is who decides the arbitrability issues, particularly of class claims, and are class claims arbitrable, may be simple, but maybe for different reasons. In this case, there's probably five key documents, maybe four. Those key documents for the court would be the arbitration agreement itself, the supplement, the motion to compel arbitration filed in the trial court, the motion to the supplemental statement of claims that includes the class claims before the arbitrator, the motion to strike filed by Home to strike that petition, and all the other attendant relief, and the order denying that relief. We believe Home wants to avoid the application of the facts of what went on in the arbitration and argue the abstract. A lot of effort has been made to talk about cases from the various circuit court and what's the majority rule and this, that, and the other. But frankly, Your Honors, that really is not going to control this case, because one thing is consistent here. The test is a clear and unmistakable manifestation of intent to have the arbitrator decide issues of arbitrability. And that's exactly what they did in this case.
Well, would you agree, counsel, that the comments that the Supreme Court has made in Oxford Health and in Stolt-Nielsen are a pretty clear signal of what the Supreme Court is going to end up doing on this question of who decides arbitrability, whether it's a procedural question versus a gateway issue for the court?
No, Your Honor, I don't, because all these cases that they're talking about is like reading tea leaves. And if I could read tea leaves for the Texas Supreme Court does, or this court or any other court, I'd be a very, very rich man. I think there's some commentary and it's fact specific, but I'm delighted that you ask about Oxford Health, because that is the case that controls the outcome of this matter we're here today, and I'll tell you why. Careful what you, as Justice Kagan said, careful what you ask for, you may just get it. And what happened in this case is they asked for relief from the arbitrator to strike the claims, to determine they weren't arbitrable, to determine that they weren't within the scope of the arbitration order. They asked for that specific relief from the arbitrator. The arbitrator denied that relief. Now, maybe that, as they said in Oxford Health, that could be an erroneous decision, but that's too bad, because they manifested an intent by that conduct that's what that arbitration clause meant. It is broad.
So you wouldn't take the position that the intent has to be manifested within the language of the arbitration clause itself?
No, Your Honor, and Texas courts construing contracts say that, and arbitration clauses are construed like contracts. For instance, if you've got a contract and it's unambiguous and you're trying to determine the intent, Texas law provides that the conduct of the parties can reflect the intent of the agreement. That's been done over and over and over again in terms of releases, in terms of all sorts of contracts, and that's exactly what they did here. Unmistakably, they did several things. First, they argued with the broadest brush that they possibly could, unmitigated, that this arbitration clause covered everything. If it touched on, weeped on, came close to the warranty issue.
But weren't they arguing that in the context of bilateral arbitration?
If you can find that term bilateral arbitration in that motion, I've looked for it, and I cannot find it, Your Honor. But that's just one part of the puzzle. Okay. They may have been arguing that, but that's not what they specified. They may have, that is not what they put in their motion. They could have said.
You're talking about the motion to compel arbitration in the first
place? Yes, Your Honor.
But that was filed before any hint of class claims had arisen, correct?
If you took that by itself, it might be a pretty strong, it might be say, okay, King's X timeout, it's only as to bilateral arbitration. Although that's not the way the motion was couched. It was said, forever, for always. Look, these people are sophisticated business people. Now, they know what the law is on class arbitration, and they know what the law is on how to do that and how to fix it. They're the ones that drafted this agreement, and it would be, we would be foolish to believe that they didn't have the legal wherewithal to specify and carve out the class arbitration doesn't apply to this arbitration agreement, like the San Antonio case they cite.
Right, but the fact that they didn't do that within the arbitration clause, do you think that that rises to, I mean, silence doesn't equal a clear intent, clear manifestation of an intent to throw class arbitration within that clause, does it?
Right, Judge, I agree. Just that alone by itself. But here we got so much more, oh, so much more that they've given this court. For instance, the relief they ask in their motion to strike was clearly indicative that they believe the arbitrator decided issues of arbitrability. Wherefore, respondents Home and WUIC request the arbitrator to sustain its objections, deny claimant's motion for class certification. That's on the merits. Strike plaintiff's first supplement to plaintiff's First Amendment petition and for such other and further relief to which they may be justly entitled. Furthermore, Your Honor, they address the arbitrability question in page 2 of their motion. Beyond the scope of the order referring to case to arbitration, they're asking the arbitrator to hold that the class action was beyond the scope of the arbitration order. Now, I don't know how, if it walks like a duck, it acts like a duck, and it quacks like a duck. This is asking the arbitrator to make decisions. If they believed that the arbitrator didn't have issues that could not decide arbitrability and certain about class arbitration, then they knew where to go. They could go to the trial court. Here's what they did. They didn't like the decision, and they ignored it, but we have an award. But the arbitrator said these claims are abated. Now, did they go back to the arbitrator, the one they sought the relief for, and they got the judgment, you know, their motion denied? They did not. They ran to Judge Fostel and ultimately to Judge Isaacs to ask for a do-over. That's not the way it works. That's exactly what Oxford Health says. Exactly what it says was you ask the arbitrator to make a ruling. Now you don't like it. Now you want a do-over, and that's exactly what they're doing. They present themselves to this court. So all the abstract about all these cases from different circuits.
Well, now, Oxford Health, though, wasn't a situation where the defendant, I mean, it wasn't quite the stipulation situation of Stolt-Nielsen, but I think, as I recall, I haven't read it in a little bit, but I think that the decision, and especially Justice Alito's concurrence, made clear that they really weren't faced with the question in that case of whether a defendant could seek a do-over, basically, in district court.
Well, I think Justice Alito said that it would be a different analysis, perhaps, if we were riding on a clean slate. We are not riding on a clean slate before this court. They're asking for a do-over. They don't like the decision they got from Mr. Seidler as the arbitrator. Why do you go and ask the arbitrator to rule on matters about arbitrability, about the merits of a class claim, if you contend that the scope of the arbitration order is exceeded or they're not arbitrable? The fact of the matter is they never addressed that.
Well, is Home correct that they went to the trial court on this class arbitration issue before Mr. Seidler issued his arbitration award?
I believe not, Your Honor. I believe not.
Can you point me someplace in the record where the sequencing of that's going to be clear?
So they went to the trial court, I believe, in May.
Mm-hmm.
May. Mr. Seidler's order denying is January 20th, 2016.
Denying what?
Denying the relief that Home requested, denying Home, motion to strike, first supplement.
Okay.
Denying all relief and abating the First Amendment statement of claims. They went, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, to the trial court after, in May. Okay,
May.
The award came down, and now I'm going to betray myself and not know when the award came down, but the award came down after this order denying.
But
it's incorporated into the award.
Right, but Mr. Seidler's award came after Home had gone to the trial court.
I'm not sure about that. I do know this. I'm quite confident that the order denying relief was after the Home went to the trial court. Why would you ask for relief, though, Judge? Okay, that's no different than if I get a visiting judge in one of these nice courts here in Fort Worth, and he makes a decision that I don't like. So I go back and I'm going to shop somewhere else. Or I've got a TRO, and I know Judge X has already denied it, so I may go talk to Judge Y and ask him to reconsider. That's forum shopping. That's exactly what happened in Oxford Health. They went back and they wanted a do-over, and they didn't like the decision. That is the posture they presented themselves to this court. Unmistakably, they presented that to themselves. They cannot get around it. What is the best evidence of the intent of that arbitration agreement other than Holmes' own words and conduct? How do you escape that? I don't know how you escape that. But that is the best. That is certainly evidence. Whether it's a collateral estoppel or whatever, who cares? It reflects the intent of what they thought. And if the court looked at their motion, it did not challenge that the arbitrator didn't have authority to rule on these matters. They asked for a ruling, and they got it. And so you take that, the broad argument and statements they make in the arbitration agreement, on the arbitration motion to compel, without exception, and then you add in what they did before the trial court. And frankly, Your Honor, I don't think it makes any difference whether they went to the trial court before the order or after. They sought the order, they got a ruling, and whether they went to the trial court at the same time, they didn't withdraw it. They didn't ask Judge Fostel to say, hey, stop this madness, stay this. This is not what this is about. They did not seek that determination. They asked Mr. Seidler for a ruling on that. They got a ruling just like they did in Oxford Health. They didn't like the ruling. And so now we're back before the trial court, and Judge Fostel has now recused himself, and now we have Judge Isaacs, who's an excellent judge, but she certainly, and the decision she reached is directly attributable to Home and how they portrayed this entire deal. So back to what I'm saying is it doesn't matter what the Webb case says or what the different circuits say about that, because we have one step beyond. None of those cases dealt with application. It was all in the abstract. What does this particular arbitration clause mean? None of those cases say, well, this is what they did, Judge, and this is what they applied, and on and on and on. That's not what happened here. In this case. So to me, to our position, Robinson's position, this is a straightforward way to do it because they have provided the evidence of intent. Don't take our word for it. They have provided it in terms of the arbitration agreement themselves and how they constructed it and how they've acted by acting Mr. Seidler about that. They didn't ask Mr. Seidler to go back and say, hey, lift your abatement. Hey, Mr. Seidler, rule on the arbitrability of the class claims, or let's reconsider it, or something else, and maybe it is something for the court to decide, or maybe class claims aren't arbitrable. I don't know. But they got their decision, but then they went shopping. I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, if I could, for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tyser.
Mr. Baines, welcome to Fort Worth.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that, Your Honor. Your Honor, along with Mr. Covington, I represent the appellees. I want to start by taking on this timeline issue of what happened when, because I think it's very important that, so the original lawsuit in this case was filed back in February of 2015, and Judge Feistel looked at the issue of bilateral arbitration and passed a ruling in July of 2015. And that was the only issue before the court. The record's very clear. That discussion was about bilateral arbitration. The briefs are right there. No discussion at that time whatsoever about the idea of there being a class arbitration. Now, the case then proceeded in arbitration, and a few weeks before the arbitration hearing was to occur in January of 2016, for the first time, an amended pleading was filed that then suggested that there was going to be class arbitration. Not surprisingly, Mr. Covington, who was handling the matter, filed a motion to strike that because it was raised a mere 2 weeks before a hearing on a residential home bilateral arbitration matter. The notion that moving to strike or opposing that last hour attempt, and the word that we used in our pleading was ambush, and I think counsel took issue with that term, but I think Mr. Covington, who was getting ready to proceed with the hearing 2 weeks before, certainly felt like, well, now I've gone from bilateral arbitration between a homeowner versus a company over a house to potential claim involving tens of thousands of claimants. I think he felt that he was being ambushed, and he filed a motion to strike.
Well, do you think that there's any merit in appellant's argument that by discussing at length the idea that these claims are ineligible for class certification and all the other arguments directed toward the merits of class arbitration in this motion to strike, that somehow you've waived or were collaterally stopped from going back to the district court to say, hey, this whole question is for you, not the arbitrator?
None whatsoever, Your Honor, because for two reasons. First is that we need to go back to the intent of the agreement. That's where all the cases take us, and that's what I'm going to address here shortly, is we need to look at the intent of the agreement to see what the intent of the parties were with respect to class arbitration. But the notion of waiver is a voluntary relinquishment of a right. And what happened there in the ambush was an attempt to move to strike that. Now, let's look at the arbitrator's reaction to that. What the arbitrator did is he stayed all proceedings, and the suggestion was, and the indication was, that the court should look at that issue and it should be briefed. Now, not only did the appellees proceed to do that before there was an order, so here's the timing. On March 8th, this is before there was a ruling, March 8th of 2016, the filing by the appellees in Jack was for the purpose of, you know, moving to defeat the notion of class arbitration and to strike that. It was on March 25th, weeks later, that the arbitrator actually issued an award. So the timeline supports that. But then something real interesting happened, which is the appellants did exactly what the arbitrator would have indicated, which is on April 25th, they brought this claim and filed it in court. So we wound up filing another opposition. The claim that is before the court is, in fact, a different one that was raised in arbitration. They brought in new counsel, Mr. Tyser. He redefined the class and brought new claims. So that was what was articulated before the court. So what we actually have now, filed on April 25th of 2016, is a new pleading, which we have opposed and which Judge Isaacs ultimately ruled upon. So I'd like to take a moment to talk about the case law, and I think we do agree that the standard that should be focused on is clearly and unmistakably, but there's been a suggestion that these cases in all these other jurisdictions, I think the very best case on this point was a case that this court decided, and Justice Walker will be familiar with that case, and that's the case of Haddock. In Haddock, it traced through some of the Supreme Court decisions, and it found that the question whether the parties have submitted a particular dispute to arbitration, i.e., the question of arbitrability, is an issue for judicial determination unless the parties clearly and unmistakably provide otherwise. It quotes the In Re Weekly Homes Texas decision of 2005 to say, absent unmistakable evidence that the parties intended the contrary, it is the courts, rather than the arbitrators, that must decide gateway matters, such as whether a valid arbitration agreement exists. Now, equally important to our discussion, the Haddock Court, Justice Walker will recall, also said that silence is not clear and unmistakable evidence of intent. So what we have here is certainly silence, but we certainly don't see anything that would be tantamount to the issue of intent. The Court of Haddock also cited to In re Ford Motor Co., a 2006 Texas decision, as saying that, that it did not constitute unmistakable evidence that the parties intended to supplant the general rule requiring the trial court to decide gateway matters in the context of a arbitration provision that was very broad, and the court can read that because it's in Ray Ford, they actually include the language. So what we're left with is a stale 2003 Supreme Court case of Greentree, which a few courts had relied upon subsequent to that. As Justice Kerr pointed out, the Supreme Court has made clear in recent decisions, including Stolt-Nielsen in Oxford, that in fact the notion that the arbitrator makes the gateway decision is not the law of the land. So I would like to turn to the limited warranty itself as we get past the issue, and I think we would suggest that the the judge's decision should be affirmed with respect to who makes a decision, which is the court. But then Judge Isaacs went on to decide the actual issue of did the arbitration provision contemplate class-wide disputes. And in doing that, you pick up the four corners of the agreement and you review the document is certainly a starting spot. And we do know by way of background from Haddock that the agreement is in fact silent on the issue of class arbitration. The word class arbitration is not mentioned and certainly so it's not expressly. The only way you're going to find it is by trying to imply it. The agreement itself uses the singular word you, reflects that any arbitration is with a homeowner. So it talks about you. It doesn't talk about a class or a group or all claimants or everyone who got a warranty. It also mentions that unresolved warranty issues are defined as issues that may arise between the parties to this limited warranty agreement, not any limited warranty agreement or other limited warranty agreements or other limited warranties that other individuals had. And of course, there are different limited warranties. It also discusses a mediation process that is to be with individuals prior to the inception of arbitration. If you're going to have, in a class setting, does it lend itself to individual mediation?
Is there mediation in this case before the arbitration?
I believe there was not in this particular case. No, Your Honor. Not a formal mediation process. There was... the agreement provides that the dispute will be submitted to an arbitrator with experience in arbitrating residential construction matters. No reference to class action. And when you think about that, you know, if you play out the logic, we now have a case with an agreement that says you should be picking an arbitrator that has experience arbitrating residential construction matters. We now have a case that is not about residential construction matters. It's about the scope of a release, and it's class action. So the agreement specifies residential construction matters expertise, and here we have a claim with potentially tens of thousands of claimants addressing the scope of a release. There's also a HUD addendum to the agreement in which certain homeowners don't have to arbitrate at all. So why would there be a class action permitted, and would it make sense in the context when certain folks who have warranties can opt out and not arbitrate at all? So I think If you look at the plain language of the agreement, the four corners, obviously silence does not mean that the parties intended to arbitrate, and there's certainly ample case law that we've cited on that. All of that would support the notion that Judge Isaacs got it right. I'd also point to something that's very important, certainly important to my client, which is the line of cases in the of Stolt-Nielsen and Concepcion, which the Supreme Court addresses the issue of manifestation of intent with respect to class-wide disputes. And really, what those cases speak to is the notion that bilateral arbitration and class arbitration are just two completely different animals, and the stakes are completely different. If you look to bilateral arbitration, there's certain advantages to court that parties might perceive. But in these Supreme Court cases, the court speaks to the disadvantages of doing that in class arbitration. The first and most important one is judicial review. So let's use our case where you have a arbitrator who was chosen based on single-family residential knowledge, who's now handling a case with potentially tens of thousands of claimants involving the scope of a release. And as we all know, your honors know because you see these matters, once an arbitrator makes a decision, absence a manifest disregard of the law or a few very narrow exceptions, there's really not a great standard of review for something that's so important. And the words that the Supreme Court uses is bet the company. So why would anyone, without expressly saying it, bet the company on a matter going to arbitrator that you really don't have a meaningful judicial review? So I would speak also to the general notion that from a timing perspective, in January of 2017, when this issue arose 2 weeks, 3 weeks before the arbitration hearing, the notion that at that time the appellees would oppose before the arbitrator something that was filed somehow becomes evidence of an intent that goes back to really the four corners in drafting of the document, that somehow we should forget about what the intent of the document is. We're now going to infer intent by conduct. Well, the playbook should be, if you want to bring a class action, don't bring a class action. Get yourself into arbitration, and then a few weeks before the hearing, then raise a class claim and see what happens in the mad scramble if you can try to come up with some intent argument. So I think it's very clear that the limited warranty agreement on the plain language does not contemplate class-wide disputes. It's all about bilateral arbitration, so this issue is properly for the court. Certainly, we believe the issue in the case law and Haddock, the very case that this court decided, which I haven't heard the appellants address at all in really in a meaningful way in briefs or in court today. We think that is really controlling on that issue along because it follows the Supreme Court cases. So we'd ask that the court, and we'd respectfully request that this court affirm the decision of Judge Isaac and her September 7, 2016 order. Thank you.
Thank you. Perkins. About open, Mr. Tyson.
Thank you. May it please the court. Nowhere mentioned in their motion to compel arbitration is the word bilateral. There's no such distinction there. Certainly, these skilled lawyers and knowing how to deal with arbitration, if they meant bilateral, they would have put bilateral. But the language they use is sweeping without qualification. Then we go back to what they did. Broad sweeping language asking the arbitrator to rule on the merits. What difference would it have made about an amended petition? Either the arbitrator has jurisdiction to decide the arbitration or they don't. Obviously, they think he did. They ask
now,
for that.
Is there any analogy to be drawn between questions of jurisdiction? For example, parties can't manufacture jurisdiction just by going to some forum and pretending as if it has jurisdiction. Could there be a similar sort of argument here that simply by talking about arbitration in before the arbitrator, class arbitration, that somehow does or does not create the ability for the arbitrator to decide arbitrability if the agreement itself didn't allow that?
Respectfully,
bad question, but you get the gist, I hope.
Respectfully, Justice Kerr, not in this case. We're not talking about that. What we're doing is, I think I heard counsel say, is we just got to go on the plain language, and you can't look intent about how they manifested and how they acted as it relates to intent. That's just contrary to well-settled Texas law, Supreme Court law. The other thing they don't ever argue about is would. Respectfully, how do you get around Wood? That's the Texas Supreme Court case. It hasn't been overruled. It hasn't been undone. And I'm not going to tell an appellate court what they got to do, but I'm pretty sure that you guys follow stare decisis with a great deal
of
respect.
In Wood, we didn't see the entirety of the arbitration clause from the agreement that Mr. O'Quinn had with what started off as a class action to begin with.
But you got better in this case. You got better. You've got somebody talking about broad, sweeping language, unqualified, and then you've got somebody asking the arbitrator to make rulings about class certification and merits. It's better than Wood, Your Honor. It is much better than Wood. You cannot, forgive the analogy, but my old partner from West Texas, you can put a tuxedo on a pig, but it's still a pig, and they manifested their intent. They cannot escape it. I didn't hear anything that said, like, hey, please don't pay attention. It reminds me of my favorite movie, is The Wizard of Oz, where they're looking at up there at the wizard, and the guy's behind the thing going like this, and they pull the curtains back, and they say, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. That's exactly what they're doing here by talking about the abstract. That's all you heard from them is the abstract of these cases, not application of law to the facts. It's inescapable. Haddock, let's talk about Haddock. Haddock is on the very narrow issue about waiver of an arbitration. Did you waive arbitration by engaging in conduct? It has been, since that time, construed narrowly. There's a case out of the Amarillo Court of Appeals. I could get it for the court, but it's a fairly recent case that construes it. I'm not saying the court has Haddock wrong, but in Haddock, you don't have somebody manifesting their intent so you can see it. It's right there for the court. I think they also talked about, well, this is a different lawsuit, and now they filed something in the trial court. Well, it's an amended statement of claims, and it talks about that. But, it really doesn't matter whether it was this lawsuit or a subsequent lawsuit. They asked the arbitrator to rule on merits. So is that an asterisk? Well, just in this case, and we got ambushed about that. I'll accept the description for purposes of argument, but they know what to do. You don't go ask the court the arbitrator to do something that you don't believe he has authority to do. That is not estoppel. That is not waiver. It is a manifestation of intent. And what more evidence, compelling evidence, can you have than them writing sweeping language about how many courts have, arbitration, if it touches upon, weeps on, whatever, it's covered. And then they go ask the arbitrator, Mr. Seidler, to rule on those matters. You simply cannot get away from that. By the way,
counsel, I believe your time has expired.
Okay, sorry. Thank you.
Thank you
Thank you.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for your argument here today. We appreciate them. They've been helpful to the court. Your case is submitted, and you're free to go about your business. Have a safe trip home. And you are dismissed. The court will be in recess for about 20 minutes until 3 or 3 o'clock docket.